Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am your host, Justin Landon, and I am joined on this episode by two of science fiction's best minds, Karen Lord and Tobias Bakel. Karen is the author of Redemption and Indigo and The Best of All Possible Worlds. Redemption and Indigo, which was her debut novel, was heavily praised, nominated for a World Fantasy Award, and winning both the Crawford and the Kitschie. Her newest and third novel, The Galaxy Game, is set to be released in the early part of 2015. She also co-hosts her own podcast, SF Crossing the Gulf, hosted by SF Signal. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, so glad to be here.
Thanks a lot for taking the time. Tobias Bakel is the author of seven novels, including the Xenowealth series, which is going to be re-released very soon, and then a Halo novel, which made him a New York Times bestseller, and two near-future thrillers titled Arctic Rising and Hurricane Fever, the latter of which was just released this July. He's a graduate of Clarion, a Writers of the Future winner, and a Campbell and Nebula Award nominee. Welcome, Toby.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you both. As Tobias and I were having various conversations on Twitter and email about having him on the show, I said to him, I said, gee, who would be a good person to bring on? And the first person he suggested was Karen Lord. And I've been a huge fan of Karen's work since I read Redemption and Indigo. God, I don't know, when did it come out from Small Beer Press? 2010 or something like that?
That's right. Yep, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read it then and loved it, and had a chance to read The Best of All Possible Worlds last year and really enjoyed that. So I was delighted to have you on. And interestingly, you both have some similar backgrounds and some similar shared experiences that make you both interesting to talk about on certain issues. And one of those is the fact that you both have grown up or lived in the Caribbean. And Karen, you live in Barbados, correct?
That's right.
Did you grow up there?
The room I'm sitting in, I have been in this house since I was three.
Wow, that's awesome. And Tobias, you grew up in...
I grew up in Grenada, which is actually one island over from Barbados. So very, very, very close.
And you've been living in the United States now for 20 years?
Yeah, I think I just celebrated 20 years of living in the States. I moved up here when I was 15, and I grew up in Grenada and left when I was 9 or 10 years old, and then moved up to the Virgin Islands, the British and U.S. Virgin Islands. I've lived in both, and then eventually ended up in Ohio.
As you do.
As you do. You know, Ohio is sort of like the Hotel California of states.
One of the biggest things I wanted to have the two of you wanted to talk about tonight is we are definitely seeing over time a trend of more and more science fiction and fantasy both coming in from places that are not traditional Western U.S., U.K., Australia perspectives. And one of those, led by the two of you and Nalo Hopkinson and a few other people, has been this concept of, you know, quote unquote, Caribbean science fiction. And I see that term actually thrown around a lot. And I don't really know what it means. And so I would be very curious to hear, maybe Karen first about what you think, that term means to you.
It's a good question, and I'm going to answer it as vaguely as possible, because I think the definition really does vary depending on the direction you're looking from. For some people, it's not really possible to say that there is Caribbean speculative fiction, because so much of Caribbean literature contains speculative elements. So if you are going to be kind of, very sort of strict genre, it's got to be rockets and robots or, you know, some kind of high fantasy, then you restrict things quite a lot. But if you decide you're going to be expansive and say, okay, you know, the literary people can look in and we can talk about things like, touches of horror and so on, ghosts and what have you, then all of a sudden there are just quite a large list to choose from. And quite a large list from publishers who are not known for publishing speculative fiction, and that's why a lot of readers don't hear about it. So that big definition really is which direction you're coming from. Are you going to be very narrow in your definition of the genre? Are you going to open it up into other expressions?
You know, one of the things I try to do is – and I slip and sometimes say Caribbean science fiction as if it's a subgenre all of its own. But one of the things I do try to do is say that I'm a Caribbean-born science fiction writer, and just saying that this is where I come from, you know, and focusing on that rather than trying to sort of kind of tag a genre of any kind. Karen makes a really good point. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Caribbean that genre is just unaware of. And, you know, for example, I was recently on a list of speculative fiction books coming out in July that IO9 put together. And one of them included my classmate, Tiffany Yannick. She and I actually went to high school together. And she's writing a sort of
I was so amazed realist. When I heard that, by the way, because I first heard of her when she was on the long list for the inaugural Book of Slit Prize.
Yeah.
And that was the year Redemption was on as well. And that was the first I heard of her. And then to discover that you knew her from back then, it was that was an interesting connection. Yeah.
She knew me as the skinny, awkward science fiction reading nerd in in high school. So I doubt she was particularly impressed. But yeah, we were classmates. We took a lot of same courses together, and we were all very, very much definitely interested in literature way back then. So it's kind of cool to see that both of us came out of that experiences with stories to tell, and that's really neat. The difference is that even though she's playing with magical realism enough to get IO9 to actually tag her as something that genre people should read, most people in genre aren't reviewing and paying attention to the book. It's being marketed or being picked up by people outside of classic genre circles. But I would consider the book very much from the same tradition, although she's speaking from the Caribbean side looking out, whereas I think probably you could make an argument that I am, you know, a little bit more steeped in the sort of hieroglyphics of science fiction. I have the rocket ships. I have a lot of the sort of elements that are very much, you know, screaming science fiction to people from the outside.
Can I just add that term magical realism gets really misused?
Yes.
So whenever I see it, I always sort of read the book to be sure.
Yes.
Because sometimes when people use it, all they mean to say is that it comes, this is basically speculative fiction that comes from somewhere in South Central America and Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's just one big lump thing. And that's not the real definition of
it. And one of the real fascinating things was, I was on a panel with Fabio Fernandez, at London Worldcon, because they had a panel that was called, South American and Caribbean fiction. And Fabio suggested I sit on it because while they had a plenty of South American panelists, they had no one from the Caribbean on it. And so he sort of grabbed me and said, hey, why don't you come and, you know, just toss out some titles and help us out here? Mm-hmm. And it turned out that the panel was actually, you know, when London Worldcon programmers put it together, I think they were thinking, whoever put it together might have been thinking Caribbean equals South America in some way, because the description was actually, you know, all about Spanish language translation. When we actually looked at it closely, we all kind of realized that, you know, it was kind of awkward to stick me on there, but it ended up being really useful in that Fabio was talking about the sort of magical realism problem, which is that it's a huge marketing machine created by Western academia and Western genre, right? Because he was talking about how hard it is to get Brazilian science fiction translated into American and Commonwealth markets, because all people expect to see and want to see is stuff that can be tagged as magical realism. Then you can say, oh, this is Fantastica from south of the hemisphere, right? And if it doesn't look like magical realism, then it's not getting paid attention to. And he was pointing out that, like, the biggest selling books in Brazil, books that are selling millions of copies, are cyberpunk and steampunk and near future and grasping with all these, like, really powerful science fictional things that are completely invisible outside of the language, due to this fact that when someone sends it to, you know, a house for translation possibilities, they look at it and they're like, it's from Brazil, but it's not magical realism. What do we do with that?
As you were describing the issue with it, it brought up something that Karen mentioned before we started recording tonight, where she said, I mentioned the Caribbean, and she said, well, be careful, because the Caribbean is, it means a lot of things, right? And
it does.
Think often we just say, like, oh, it's like, you got all those islands down there, and a lot of them are Spanish speaking, right? And then a lot of them aren't. but a lot of the big ones are Spanish speaking. So I think that's a trap that people can fall into.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, Tiffany Yannick, I just I Googled her as you were speaking.
Okay.
And I read the cover copy, and it very specifically references two writers, one of whom is, of course, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, because in the world of magical realism or something that codes magical realism, of course, you have to mention Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And, of course, it also mentions Toni Morrison. It's interesting to me that a novel that is about the Caribbean and it seems to be riffing on Caribbean themes is distinctly referencing an American writer and a South American writer. And
well, because this is how in America you sell something from a person of color to the larger audience, which is that you immediately sort of brand it as magical realism. And, you know, I can kind of complain a little bit about that because here, you know, one of my great frustrations with being quote unquote a, you know, Caribbean born science fiction writer is that, there's a tremendous pressure on me to actually sit down and write a magical realist novel and stop fiddling around with this action science fiction stuff I'm doing. And I flat out had editors tell me that if I would just, you know, do that, if I were to write a magical realist immigrant story, they would be able to double, if not triple my ask and do something much more interesting because they would immediately then get that same blurb, that same comparison. You know, it's like, you know, they would just say he's the Grenadian Juno Diaz, you know,
and
start pushing you like that, you know, and it's really hard to resist that because there's a machinery for that, both in academia, which really has kind of, set down on that, and, in the bookstores as well. And I think it's really clever of her publishers to push her really well. She's doing, you know, really well awards wise and book wise. And I think it's fantastic, but, yeah, it's like this channel that sometimes they immediately kind of go like, oh, great, we can just do this. Here's a person of color. Here's a magical realist thing. Let's just match them all up because after all, it's all the same thing, isn't it?
And now, Karen, your first novel, which is Redemption and Indigo, it's much more fairy tale to me than it is sort of magical realism, but it is more of a literary bent.
Well, I think... First of all, I think that I wrote the book very much unaware of a lot of the boundaries and the lines and the definitions, which was probably the best thing possible for me. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was that I have to praise Small Bear Press, because Small Bear Press kind of just takes your manuscript as is, and you're not kind of forced into a mold of any kind. So I think they were in a way the perfect publishers to take on what I had, because otherwise it would have been just too hard for maybe a more traditional publisher to market. The real origins in the sense of genre, subgenre for Redemption Indigo actually goes back to the retold fairy tales, things like The Nightingale and Snow White, Rose Red, and so on. I read those and I liked them quite a lot. And what I did was I turned that concept to some of the folk tales that I enjoyed. So, for example, there's a novelette you will never see, which is based on an Italian folk tale. That, I think, was the first one that I did. And then when I wanted to stretch myself to novel length, I took this West African folk tale that I had read. So when people then say things like, oh, it's magical realism or it's literary or whatever, these were not things I was aiming for. This was not me consciously trying to imitate somebody in a particular field or whatever. It was just the concept of you take a folktale or a fairy tale and you make it into something that has, I want to say modern relevance, but it's actually a paradox, because the cool thing about a good myth or a good fairy tale is that it is, in fact, eternal. It is, in fact, something that can be both ancient and contemporary.
Pay really careful attention. Your book has hints or possibilities that it is not necessarily set in the far past.
Exactly. And not only that, because this was a question that was raised, you know, when we were going through the manuscript, where it was like, well, here are these different levels of technology. You know, you have kind of buses going through the towns, but then you have, you know, kind of people drawing water from the well in the village. And what era are we in? And I said, well, look at the world. the world right now, you have planes in some places and you have wells in other places and people riding donkeys. And it's not strange. It's not like fantasy where we immediately know, oh, swords and horses. Okay, we're in this sort of quasi-medieval era. It's not like that. The real world has always been able to hold a large range of technologies. That's really what that is. And it fits well into the whole idea of a myth or a fairy tale is timeless.
It's also it circles around to a point about what is, you know, someone who's Caribbean and writing science fiction. I think of Gibson's quote, you know, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed.
Exactly.
I remember going from, you know, a leaky sinking boat in Grenada to an apartment with cable to, you know, moving up to the U.S. Virgin Islands. 'Cause, you know, Grenada is fairly rural. And, you know, visiting relatives where there was, you know, it was really, really, you know, dirt floor type situations. And then, you know, ending up, you know, just 3 years later, flying on a plane all the way to the States and seeing highways, trains, and, you know, just, the massive sprawl of cities. And that 4 years just being such a dramatic change, you know, from seeing my first elevator ever to, you know, landing in Washington, D.C. And, that is such an experience that's always stuck with me, that the idea that, like, you know, a world, when you're building it in science fiction, has to have one specific level of technology and everyone has it. Such a uniquely American suburban concept. It shows you that people who read science fiction and assume that, you know, a technology would have to be evenly distributed throughout an entire society, you know, live in sort of a, you know, with a set of series of assumptions that they don't really examine necessarily. And so when they come across something that has uneven amounts of technology distributed in it, that throws them for a loop. When, as Karen points out rightfully, throughout the rest of the world, you know, you can ride an ox cart through the middle of a, you know, a city with skyscrapers next to high speed rail. I mean, these things happen in other parts of the world, and it is a tremendous part of the human narrative, and it should be a part of the science fictional narrative. And, you know, that goes back to this idea of what is a Caribbean born science fiction writer. I was just answering someone who wanted to know, like, why is it that I spend so much time incorporating the Caribbean into my work? Like, why is it that I really go out of my way to do it? And I kind of had this initial reaction of thinking, I really don't go out of my way to do it. The problem is that other people notice it because I'm coming from somewhere else that has a different set of assumptions. And so their assumptions collide with what's going on in my work. So if I have no assumption that technology should be equally distributed throughout an entire culture, if I write something, I'm going to, you know, put in differing levels of technology. And the moment a science fiction reader who's comes from a profoundly suburban experience, who's only read science fiction that is rooted in that sort of American experience of really spread out technology being the same, they encounter this work and they start going like, well, there's been some serious copy editing problems in this work. You know, that's their first reaction. And it's really always interesting to me, the number of people who will like read Crystal Rain, my first book, and go like, this is such bad world building, they'll say. It's such bad world building. You know, people have, you know, such differing levels of technology and nothing actually is consistent across this entire, like, you know, landscape. And that really bugs them because it's an unexamined worldview that is profoundly core to their identity without them even really realizing it. And it's just something then that makes my work look very different without my trying to. It's just a part of who I am and where I grew up that I bring with me. And so it's not like I sat there and thought, how can I make this work harder for people to, you know, bump into, or how can I make people, like, you know, feel that I'm different? It's not like I set out to, like, be like, I'm Caribbean, here, let's put it in your face. It's just that there's just a set of things that I come with. But also, you know, because I've encountered the assumptions of the US, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of running a little long here, but like, being an immigrant, you know, having come from a place with a different set of cultural assumptions and moved to a place with a different set of cultural assumptions, you suddenly realize that different cultural assumptions exist. Exactly. And just unlocking that is sort of like dropping a UV filter. You know, you're going like, wow, the world looks really different if you put this set of filters on. This is really fascinating. You kind of feel like you've got like the infrared vision of the predator when you're running around. It's like, I can see you hiding in the mud. You know, if I turn the filter off, you're invisible, but now I see you. And there are all these things that, because you know that there are cultural assumptions, if you've only grown up in one place and if you've never understood it, you suddenly have a very different view of a lot of different things. And so that permeates my work. And even stuff that is not inherently quote unquote Caribbean, often if you are from the Caribbean, if you're reading it, a lot of times you'll catch on to things that are part of the shared experience. And it's always very cool to get a Caribbean reader kind of ping me about a story that most people read as straight science fiction or straight genre. And they will say like, aha, I see what you're doing here. And you kind of go like, I'm sorry, I can't, it's not something you can suppress.
And I just want to address something that Tobias said that's very important. It's not just that our work is different. It's not just that our work contains things that people don't necessarily get, but it's running into that assumption from the readers that you must have made a mistake, that you've somehow got it wrong. That is one of the most challenging things about this, because you really do have to sort of learn to stand up for yourself and sort of stick to what you've written, because you know that it's, as you say, you know, they've got this filter on and they've worn it for so long they don't even realize it's a filter. And they just see something that is out of their norm and they figure, well, if it's out of my norm, it's incorrect. Hmm. As opposed to it's something different. So when people say, oh, you know, we want diversity in science fiction, I'm like, do you really know what you're asking for? Do you really? I had an experience recently, which was my epiphany in a way. I read Hurricane Fever and I loved it. And at some point I suddenly felt, wait a minute, is this what the average Western reader feels all the time? Reading a book that is just so intimately plugged into your lived experience that, you know, it just feels like you can be completely and fully immersed in it. And I realized to what extent so much of my reading has been reading from the periphery. But I've been so accustomed to that, that maybe for me it's easier to find diverse works because, you know, Western literature in some respects can be just as strange as, you know, literature from other parts of the Commonwealth, from India or something from China. It will all be strange on a sort of spectrum, on a range. Yes, mm-hmm. I will know the UK culture better. I will know the US culture and Canadian culture better than some of the other places, but it's still strange. And like I said, I read Hurricane Fever and everything was just familiar. And I was like, wow. Imagine I've been reading all this time. I didn't have this experience. Oh, and I just want to point out, I didn't have the experience because even though I had Caribbean literature, you're still reading, say, a book by a Jamaican author and you yourself have never been to Jamaica, for example. Mm-hmm. You read a book by a Barbadian author, but he's writing about a time which is your parents' or your grandparents' generation. So it's still at a remove. It's historical and it's not your present-day experience. I mean, when I say present-day experience, of course, Hurricane Fever is near future, but it's near enough future that it feels like now. Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely amazing. And I don't know how to deal with that sometimes. How do you explain to people that, as you know, as Tobias says, that there are other parts of the visible spectrum that they're not accessing when it comes to the literature?
Well, in my perspective as a Western reader, born, raised, and functioning mostly, that I'm not getting a chance to actually see these alternative views, as you mentioned earlier, Tobias, because things like what Fabio Fernandez suggested in his country of Brazil are not being translated, that they're, mm-hmm. we're not getting them because we've put certain places in a box. You know, Chinese
boxes are relentless. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Like it's so hard for me to imagine that the US publishers aren't interested in finding a translation of something that's selling millions of copies in Brazil that is, you know, rockets and dragons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes down to that question of like, well, how do we sell this? You know, like known quantities, unknown quantities. It becomes hard for them to kind of, you know, it's hard for people to get out of the rails, which they're comfortably sitting in, you know, and it takes a lot of work. And the easiest way to change that is for people to, you know, straight up demand more. you know, and ask for more and search for more and raise their voices for more. That does have, you know, people will listen. We just, you know, we do live in a capitalist economy. So if more consumers of this stuff say, hey, you know, we'd like to read that, that does go somewhere. It's like, you know, one of the great frustrations is you know, seeing something like, you know, The Abyss and Apex does like an international science fiction issue. And they often mention that they sell, you know, so few copies of those books, which are specifically designed to pull from all over the world, you know, stuff with speculative fiction elements. But, you know, people immediately walk away from it because a lot of people have two things. There are two reasons. One is the cod liver theory of literature, which is that a lot of people have been told that they should read diverse literature because it is quote unquote good for them. And so what they think is like, you know,
like cough syrup.
Yeah, it's like cough syrup, right? You know, it's like literature cough syrup. They're being told it's good for you. I'm saying it's good for you because it's friggin' fun and it expands your horizons. I think it's good for you the same reason reading science fiction is good for you. It gives you new viewpoints and it gives you new literature. And I often have to tell people like, hey, look, there's some diverse authors that you're going to read that you're not going to like, and it's totally okay. I don't like all the diverse authors that exist out there in the world, you know, like, but you keep reading because you're going to look for someone that you latch onto and think, crap, this is really good. And I want to read more. And you get, you know, you find that stuff and you keep going with it. And that is one thing that people have in their heads, which is this cod liver theory oil. Like, I don't want to read something that's good for me. And a lot of people come to the assumption that diverse equals inferior or added due to quota or not fun. And the fact of the matter is all the work that I'm talking about that I think is out there is all like fascinating and good. And there's a wide variety of it. So it's just a case of like, get out there, sample it, see if anything strikes your fancy. If it doesn't, move on and find something else. But I guarantee you that if you had actually like, you know, shift your sampling habits, you can find diverse literature from all over the world that feeds whatever it is you enjoy, because everyone else is producing action and adventure and tackling topics that will be up your alley. And, you know, like when I try to do this outreach about, you know, more diverse or international fiction, that pushback I get is just sort of this, here, let me sit you down with a bunch of novels and you pick the two out of this batch of 20 that interest you. And there you go. Look, you've just expanded your reading horizons and found two new authors that you really adore. I mean, there's really nothing that's going to harm you in just trying at least a chapter.
Yeah, Karen, I'm curious about this. I read The Best of All Possible Worlds. As I read it, I struggled with how to frame it in my mind. The story structure is different than what we're used to, I felt like. And I'm curious, as we've talked about this idea of what Caribbean science fiction is or what other types of science fiction are, you know, from different parts of the world, how much of it is informed by what you talk about with Toby here, which is, you know, I see myself or I see the cultural cues that I'm looking for, and how much of it is a storytelling tradition that is, it's just a fundamentally different way of telling a story?
Ooh, that's a heavy question. And of course, the answer is both. I think the one thing that both of them do have in common, which does point to a Caribbean tradition, is the sense of the narrator, the sense of the oral tradition of storytelling. That is deeply West Indian. You almost can't get away from that. I always say to people, we already have a rich literary tradition, but if you ignore the oral tradition that goes even further back, you will miss a lot of the true influences on Caribbean authors. So the fact that I can either have an omniscient narrator like in Redemption, or have a narrator who is first person for The Best of All Possible Worlds, it actually does come from the same root. But I would say that the structure is not completely unusual. I mean, the whole kind of it's actually episodic. It's actually done almost like a miniseries, each chapter being an episode. So in some respects, it's doing your oral tradition thing, but in other respects, it's actually borrowing from another medium entirely. And because when I was writing it, it was more visual for me than Redemption was in some ways. So I did almost see it like a TV episode that was playing out and wrapped up in 45 minutes.
So, and this goes at the fact that there are a lot of different ways to tell stories that are not just these, the very Western three-act structure with conflict and resolution, and conflict and genre often being manifested physically. I'm thinking of this article that was up at this, this Tumblr called Still Eating Oranges, not too long or a while back about.
I remember that.
Yeah. Sorry. About the Japanese plot structure of Kisho Tenketsu, which contains four acts, introduction, development, twist, and then reconciliation. And where the way in which things are done is very different than that traditional three-act conflict-oriented structure. If you get a chance, it's always interesting to get online and read that article because it strikes the fact that there are a lot of different ways to tell stories out there, and culturally we've received a lot of different ways to tell stories. And moving away from it can create some challenges, but it doesn't, you know, it's something that's just as valid.
And something that can stretch you as a writer, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first started to write the manuscript that would become Best of All Possible Worlds, initially I was trying to practice a short form.
Oh, really?
And that's why, because I think I'm really bad at it. So, I was trying to practice a short form, and what really happened is that it was a series of short stories that then became more and more involved because I got more and more interested in the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Then after revision, like I said, it's the manuscript that would become that because obviously there was a lot of revision and so forth. But it really did start off as just, you know, okay, I'm just writing this. And then it sat there and I'll be like, you know, I kind of have an idea for another one. And then I just write, okay, just that. I got to go back to writing my other stuff. And then I'll be like, oh, there's still another story to tell. So it's almost like me being dragged back reluctantly to do just another story. And then, as I said, it became like watching TV in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Where I could only justify, because I was writing the sequel to Redemption at the time, so I was trying to be all disciplined and professional and doing my word counts and stuff, and I was like blocked massively, and words were just flowing for the Best of All Possible Worlds. So I restricted myself. I was like, "You're only allowed to write this much. Then you have to get back to what you're supposed to be doing."
I don't know about you, Toby, but I'm like, the sequel to Redemption, where's that at? You can't tease me like that.
Oh, you know, that Redemption. That is with me about to get a couple more tweaks and rewrites and go back to my very excellent local editor. You remember Robert Tobias?
Yes, Robert Sandiford.
He did a first pass with him. I've got such a complicated relationship with that manuscript right now because I wrote it the worst way. And that way was after I got my first literary prize for Redemption Indigo. It's a local literary prize, but one that's held in very high regard. Kamal Brafford has won it twice. So, you know, it's taken very seriously. And I kind of felt panicked. I kind of felt like I have to write another book to show them that I'm not a one-hit wonder. I have to write another book to show them that this isn't a fluke. So if you sit down to write with this sense of I have to prove myself, it just doesn't go well. It really doesn't. But I'm trying to kind of bleed all the pretentiousness out in the rewrites. But yeah, I tried to stretch myself in that manuscript, and I probably tried to do things that I wasn't ready for. And in a way, that's what Best of All Possible Worlds is about as well. When I was trying to do stuff and it wasn't working, I would say, okay, well, you know, I'll go back to Best and I'll write a story where I deal with this thing I'm trying to do. It's not working in the sequel. So there are all these writing exercises tucked into the novel as well. I'm sorry. It was Best of All Possible Worlds. I do apologize. It's actually very close to my heart because it was such an unexpected work for me. It really just took on a life of its own. And it was really my happy place for quite a long time because I was writing some really dark stuff in the sequel to Redemption. Stuff that I am not accustomed to having to deal with. Stuff I was trying to avoid, and then I'd hit a block, and then I'd have to go back and write the worst, horrible stuff because that was just the way the story was going. So really, going to Best of All Possible Worlds and just having a character who was at least lighthearted in voice, even if she had her own demons, you know, below the surface, was just like a relief. Mm-hmm. And I also like the way that it just took its own direction. So it was more like letting a plant grow and then coming back and pruning it.
Now, Toby, in your novels, and you write quite a bit of short fiction or have written quite a bit of short fiction over the course of your career.
Yeah.
Your novels, though, are, at least in my estimation, especially your two most recent ones, are pretty traditional, very thriller-oriented. Have you ever considered taking a different, completely different kind of narrative structure and taking it to the novel?
You know, actually, with Hurricane Fever, I used a four-act structure, although I don't know how apparent it is to anyone who's looking at it when I set it up. You know, I'm a pacing junkie, so I'm constantly...
You're so good at it.
Yeah. So, you know, my trick is to try and figure out what the ebb and flow of the novel feels like and make sure that there's an organic speed with which I can pull the reader through. And every writer has something that they get obsessed with. And for some reason, when it comes to writing, that's something I really love. There's some things I wish I were differently obsessed with, you know, on the line level. It's hard because sometimes the work you love to read and the writers you admire the most are not necessarily the writers that you are like as a writer yourself. Mm. And sometimes there's a disconnect there that can be, you know, frustrating. William Gibson said when he was writing Neuromancer, he tried to put the novel together in such a way that, like, there was no point at which anyone could be bored at any given point in it. And boy, did that just pluck like a string in my soul, because that's whenever I'm trying to put a novel together, that's the thing I'm most interested in of the mechanics, which is just like, you know, how can I build this in such a way that you don't want to put this down? And that's kind of what I obsess over. There's all sorts of larger meta stuff that I'm always playing with. I want to talk about climate change. I want to talk about the future of Caribbean politics. I want to talk about sort of subverting the James Bond tropes with it. But ultimately, like, you know, when I'm actually writing each individual chapter, I'm always sort of sitting there worrying, like, is this a place where he can put it down? The reader, will she just, like, you know, give up right here because it looks like it's a nice stopping place? So it's like, I'm always trying to just focus on that level and less on the bigger act structure. So I've experimented with a bunch of different structures for novels. With Crystal Rain, I had, like, you know, these six POVs all multiply threaded together, with a sort of general three-act structure. But with Ragamuffin, I ended up doing a real interesting kind of thing, which some people have dinged me for, but I kind of had a structure where basically I rewind time and go back a lot and start over in another place and tell the story, which some people really did not like. and then Sly Mongoose, I did a more traditional three-act structure with just two POVs. Arctic Rising is down to one POV. Actually, there is no three-act structure in that book. I just tried to do it as feels like it has a momentum that keeps speeding up until you hit the end and you're just like, crap. A lot of the stuff that I'm doing in terms of, like, you know, different cultural narratives or structuring it differently, that stuff's invisible to me on a large part. I mean, Karen just told me that she was reading one of my short story collections and she could see the Caribbean all over it, including, you know, many stories that, like I said, I don't necessarily think of as necessarily having a strong Caribbean influence. And that's always interesting to me to see, you know, how that stuff is popping out in places I don't realize.
I don't imagine that anybody ever emails like George Martin and says, "Wow, man, I can't believe you're doing all this Western commentary in here.
Look at all this Mexico influence that's just bubbling out of Game of Thrones." Mm. You know, George, how do you hearken, you know, how do you look to New Mexico culture for inspiration for your writing? That's a very good point. I mean, it's sort of like that thing where, like, female writers are always asked, you know, like, how do you juggle writing and having kids? And no one has ever asked me that.
Karen, you have the Galaxy game coming out in January. You know, I've read the blurb, obviously. I actually just got a copy of it yesterday. And so I'll be reading it soon. But as I read the blurb, it seemed to me that maybe you were trying to do something perhaps a little different than what you did in The Best of All Possible Worlds. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. I have a suspicion that every book I write is different, which is maybe a little bit disconcerting for somebody who comes back to a series to get very much more of the same thing. But I'm hoping that readers will find it worthwhile.
I wrote an article earlier this week about my theories about the series and how the way that we discuss books and the way we talk about books and the way that we market books is perhaps going to create a challenge for the series in the future, in that we're always constantly pushing for new ideas and the new thing, especially on the internet where a lot of this conversation is taking place. We're always demanding something new to stimulate us. And so it's interesting that both you and Tobias have written two books that are set in the same world, but at least for all intents and purposes, appear to be books that can be read completely independent of one another.
That's kind of the Discworld model, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely hearkening to the Discworld model.
Right, old school and how new they are. Which is always...
Everything goes back around to everything again. It's just a giant circle, man.
Which is always true, right? It's something that Max Gladstone has recently done as well, where he's got these three novels that are all connected, and you can get something by reading all of them, but you don't really have to. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in this idea moving forward in a kind of a world where, you know, there's no guarantee that people are going to have read the previous stuff, and without shelf space, there's no guarantee they're going to feel compelled to pick up the previous stuff. And so trying to write something that'll appeal to both these existing fans and trying to grab new readers, it seems like a very sensible thing to me to do. Is it something that you've thought about?
Well, I'm actually not kidding about Discworld. I really did, as a reader, reach a point where I grew fatigued with series. And when I say I grew fatigued, you have to appreciate it. In the days before internet and ordering stuff online, you're pretty much dependent on the bookstores being able to provide your full series for you. I cannot tell you how many times I started trilogies and 4 and 5 book series in the middle because that's what the bookstore had, or because that's what a friend had. And then you're kind of scrambling to like get the rest together. And sometimes you never finish it because you just couldn't source the final ones. And some of them were worth the effort, and some of them kind of wished you hadn't bothered. And the only one that I kind of kept returning to was Discworld, because there was enough continuity that you could get a batch together, like the witches or the guards, you know, that he would come back to these particular characters again. But you could also get something completely fresh, like pyramids, or something like, you know, the god who became a turtle and brother was carrying him around. How can I forget this?
Tobias, how can you not remember one of these 22 novels?
It's on the tip of my tongue.
I know. Okay. Somebody's going to be listening to this podcast and laughing at this book, but I will keep going. The point is, you would get these amazing little gems that are just like these little standalone things, and he can do that. And you're happy to still go along with him because, and he had this lovely trick of giving you a major character as a cameo. Sorry?
Small gods?
Small gods. Yes, man. Thank you.
It's an abomination under Nuggin. Right, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So you have these lovely situations where there's a character who just has a little cameo. You know, so he was starring in his book before, and then suddenly there's just this one little scene that's got a little bit of death or a little bit of Granny Weatherwax, and that's all you need. You're just like satisfied, hugely satisfied, and then you keep reading about these new characters and you're happy, and that's all you needed. And I guess that's almost the model I'm working with now, where that's the level of connection that my books would have, where you have just, you know, one or two people that you remember from previously. Some of the main people have become more peripheral now because they're off doing other things. That's the way the world works. You know, you have friends and relatives that are very close to you at a certain point in your life, and then they go farther afield or you do. And that's just the ebb and flow. And it feels very natural to do. We don't all band together and go on a quest. You know, we're not always able to keep the same characters around us for, like, you know, 7 books or whatever. You know, there's precedent. There's plenty of precedent for it. I mean, you can even argue that some of the real old school ones, Sherlock Holmes, for example, so just steps slightly out of the genre into another genre, does take the idea of we will have familiar characters. We will have, like, you know, people that you keep coming back to, but we can still go off and do some quite different things. And the Agatha Christie, of course, as well, she had her groups that she would return to from time to time. Sometimes it depends, I think, on the author as well, because you're really talking about two different approaches. epic fantasy that has multi-volume works is really supposed to be trying to tell one story across many volumes, like the original Lord of the Rings, not separate stories that happen to be like joined together, you know. So I'm not saying that the sort of multi-volume series is a bad idea. I think that if people approach it as if they're writing one massive book that happens to be cut up into, you know, manageable portions, I think sometimes that can work very well. But if you have someone who clearly begins to ramble because they didn't have that full story in their head, or because maybe they had it, then it started to evolve even as the publications went out, you can detect that. And that's where you sometimes start to lose you as a reader at that point.
That's something I've put a lot more thought into than when I was starting out. When I first wrote Crystal Rain, you know, all I was trying to do was write Crystal Rain. When Tor came back to me and said, hey, the idea was to write a sequel to Crystal Rain. And I hadn't put a lot of thought into that, like what would happen if they came back to me for another book. So I was sort of panicked. But I wasn't sure whether this was a series that picked right off where the other one let off and continued with a story, or if this was a universe like Discworld that I set a lot of stories in. So when I wrote Ragamuffin, it became a direct sequel. And you can think of Crystal Rain and Ragamuffin kind of like a duology. You know, it's a big book, two halves, everything kind of, you know, is, you read one and read the other, and there's a lot going on between the two books. But when it came time to write Sly Mongoose, I realized I did not want to continue with that. I just wanted to sort of do the Discworld model and continue taking the stories and running with them and setting them up so that people who would read the books can read them out of order without necessarily needing to have read all the other books that came before them. This hasn't been something I set out to do on purpose. I just kind of been fumbling my way through the whole thing.
Well, I just wanted to add one thing. There's a slight modification to the Discworld model in the way that I know you said that, you know, you can read books without having read them out of order, or you can read them, you know, sort of a standalone. But then if they have read some of the previous ones, they get a little extra.
Yeah.
It's almost like having access to Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I even within a single book, I actually write a single book like that, where as you go through kind of according to the book's chronology, you get one story. And then by the time you get at the end, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. There are all these other things though that look far more significant. I need to go back and read it again. So every book that I write is written to be read probably at least three times. And I'm still exploring what that means in the context of series within a world, but mm-hmm. I would like to think that then if I start to have sequels, you know, again, there will be points where not only when you go back and read the book again will you be enriched, but when you go back and read the other books that form the foundation or the start, a lot more things will start to become significant, become clear, and it'll give you that, the whole, I don't know how to put it, it's almost like this ping you get, this sort of virtuous echo where it's like, ah, yes, you know. And I like that feeling of satisfaction. I mean, Tobias may talk about his obsession being pacing. My obsession is weaving throughout the story little references that you may gloss over. But then when it all comes together, it's like, bing, and it all just fits together. Gives you that.
I love that, because one of the things I used to talk about in writing workshops and when talking to people about writing is to, you know, a lot of writers, one of the big mistakes I see with brand new writers is they want to hold back the cool stuff, you know, and lock it up and have it come back later in the book. And I always tell people, you know, assume people are reading this book for the second time. Mm-hmm. Just start with that assumption. Just start with the assumption that your book was interesting enough that someone's read it once and they're reading it again. Is that trick that cool? Do you need to hide it? Uh-huh. Or can you just put that right up front and let us get to it and see what it is and do even more cool stuff? And I think looking at your work with an eye towards thinking about the what people get out of it on a second and like you said, a third read is a very powerful thing.
Any book that only works if you don't know what happens is a failure, I think.
Really?
Yeah. Ooh,
like, I have to remember that one.
Like, I really think that everybody's always super spoiler conscious. I'm like, spoil me. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, if it's a good book, the spoilers mean nothing.
Exactly.
I have read A Storm of Swords 15 times, it seems like. I actually haven't read it that many. I've read it like 4 times, but I reread it a couple years ago, and it's like, if you know the Red Wedding's coming, the butterflies start on like page 300. Like, it doesn't happen until page 850, but like the butterflies start because you know it's going to happen, right? And you're dreading it the whole time. Like, I actually think spoilers sometimes heighten the nervousness of a book. I think that's a good point, Toby. I totally agree.
Oh my gosh. The first time I watched, the Hitchcock movie with the stabbing.
Psycho.
You know, because no one told me it was in a shower. They're just like, oh yeah, when she gets stabbed, you know, suddenly out of nowhere. Like, that's just so horrific. So like the first 15 minutes of that movie for me, because it had been spoiled for me, were so intense that I kept having to pause it to go get a drink of water because I couldn't handle it. Because I'm like, when is she going to get stabbed? How is she going to get stabbed? When is she like – she's like unfolding her like stuff on the bed in the motel, and I'm just sort of a bundle of nerves going, when does she get stabbed? When does she get stabbed?
That's great.
If spoilers mattered, we wouldn't still be doing Shakespeare.
Ooh.
That's a good point. We all know how those end.
Yeah.
So I have one other observation that I kind of played with. I'm like, I don't know if there's anything here to talk about or not, but we'll find out if there is. I was kind of looking at the narrative arcs of both of your most recent novels, and it's interesting that Karen's novels, The Best of All Possible Worlds and now The New Galaxy Game, both deal with this kind of like world-altering event where this whole planet, essentially, or this entire people die. And the only ones who survive are the ones who weren't around when the tragedy happened, and so they're sort of like picking up the pieces. Meanwhile, in Tobias's most recent novels, the catastrophe hasn't really happened yet, but it's looming. It's like this looming sense of climate change, and that like, if we don't get a handle on this, if we don't figure it out, this life-altering, world-altering thing is going to happen. And it's interesting to me that you're both playing with this concept. In one case, Karen's more in the aftermath and Tobias is more on the horizon. But it's interesting to me that two people with perhaps a mildly similar worldview were both very much grappling with this concept of this out-of-control event that one person can't really influence but has to deal with. And I'd be curious to see if you feel like that is something that has been fundamentally informed by your point of view or where you've come from.
I'm gonna tell a little story, which I'm quite sure you can like, embellish on. But I'm remembering when I went to Wales to start my PhD, and it was near the end of the hurricane season, and I'm looking at the maps, and Hurricane Ivan is a Category 5, and it is like kissing distance to Barbados. And I'm just like, I don't know what to do. I do not know what to hope or pray for, because when it's like that, even if you don't get hit, somebody's going to get hit. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was that it very, very anomalous. Usually they kind of drift north by the time they reach us. It dips south and hit Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
Grenada doesn't usually, Grenada's like on the edge when it comes to being hit by hurricanes. So we would even get more than they do, and we're kind of on the edge sometimes ourselves. And I think it had at least decreased to a Category 3 by the time it hit, but it really, really did some damage, and it took the economy a very long time to recover. And especially, as I said, when you are in a country that it's not like you see a hurricane every 5 years, you know, it's like the last one was, you know, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. There's a kind of complacency that comes with that generation where perhaps you're not as prepared as you could be, especially in terms of your housing stock and so forth. That's something we face every year, and I think that does become something that becomes part of the worldview. But go ahead, Toby. Yeah.
No, that is, I think that's really good. I you know, I immediately wrote down, you know, I think some of it is the fact that we have lived in small nations that are both buffeted by natural forces and geopolitics, mm-hmm. that are vaster and larger than themselves.
Yes.
And so I think the worldview in part is that we have always sort of paid attention to and have been trying to figure out how to survive these, you know, these larger forces that are going on. If you live inside of the U.S., you know, a friend of mine once very sarcastically said, I'd much rather be a victim of U.S. domestic policy than U.S. foreign policy. which is a very funny one-liner. But like when you live outside of the U.S. and you're in a smaller country, you know, you're in an area where people are playing what's called like quote unquote the game. One of my frustrations, you know, like, what is the spy game, the global game, which is to try and figure out how, you know, the Russians are trying to figure out how to develop their influence. The Americans are trying to develop their influence. Right now, that's really big, you know, China versus the U.S. in the Caribbean. They're trying to figure out who can spend and gain and manipulate and get, you know, UN Council votes and all of this other fun stuff like that, which, you know, if you're domestic inside of the U.S., that's just something that happens off in the distance. But if you're living in those places, those things are pertinent. These larger forces are outside of you, and they're basically trying to control your fate for their own interests. And sometimes that can be benevolent, and sometimes it cannot be benevolent. And yeah. And you just get caught in these whirlwinds, you know, both of nature and of geopolitics, that are in some ways out of your control. And one of the things I remember seeing at 4 years old was, you know, American, you know, planes flying overhead, and, you know, the intervention or the invasion, depending on who you talk to, you know? And so that's what I grew up with. And that happened because, you know, not because there were, you know, students trapped there, because the students were actually offered to be airlifted off the island, but they said they were working on finals week at the medical school and they didn't want to stop for finals. You know, things proceeded and then they got scared and it was used as an excuse for the invasion or intervention, depending on your point of view. That was done for all sorts of reasons. And so you think of, you know, an island of 100,000 people sort of being exposed to the full brunt of international politics, because it's Cuba, it's Russia, and it's America all trying to sort of play out the Cold War in miniature on one small Caribbean island. And those sorts of games are still kind of happening. And so when you grow up with that happening around you, when you're just one, you know, you're just one person of 100,000 and you're looking up and going like, wow, the full force and might of, you know, the US and, you know, Russia through Cuba are all kind of pivoting in this place. When you learn that at 4 years old, it colors everything, I think.
It does. And you know what else? It goes way back. Because if you're talking about the Napoleonic Wars, if you're talking about even the World Wars, we've always been in a strategic place where, you know, islands have switched hands between colonial powers. We've got like forts. We've got systems of forts all around Barbados. We've got a huge like garrison area, because there's always been, even though we're these little rocks, we're strategic little rocks.
Yes.
And as you say, you always get the sense of big things happening. And often big things that you can't control.
Yeah.
And maybe it's interesting you said that Bess doesn't really have that external conflict thing as much, or rather the external conflict is not, I mean, it happens almost like off stage, right? And then the people themselves, the conflicts they're dealing with, are on a sort of a smaller, more personal scale. But part of that, again, mirrors our history and our presence and our reality, where sometimes the things that happen are far beyond what we can do, our influence or whatever. We're not going to go all Luke Skywalker and overthrow the evil empire here. You know, the most that we can do is, as Tobias said, find our own survival, find our own way to preserve what we have and to continue into the next generation. And that's what our history has always been about, right? From genocide and slavery and war and all the way through it.
Well, let's think about, you know, the two very different histories. I mean, the U.S. comes out of this history of the Revolutionary War and grabbing, you know, through violence and conflict, the control of their quote unquote destiny. And Caribbean islands have, you know, slave revolts being put down horribly by the same colonial empires, you know, and it being a 200-year process of trying to grab independence, and one that has only basically been fully realized since the, you know, 60s and 70s. So, like, it's, you know, such different histories and such different cultural backgrounds and such different, you know, and just being an island that's that small, I see a lot of, you know, a lot of similarities when I look at, you know, fiction from other places that are small and are trying to figure out, how do we make our way in a world? You know, how do we make a third or fourth different path that does not enable, you know, that does not result in us getting kind of caught up in these whirlwinds?
Exactly.
I like it when I ask a question like that, that I have no idea what the answer is going to be, and the answer turns out to be a good one. So anyway, I have kept the two of you very long tonight. Thank you for your patience with some internet issues.
It's been a pleasure.
And all of that.
Yeah. But thank you very much.
It's been a blast. This has been Tobias Bakel and Karen Lord. Hurricane Fever is in stores now, and Galaxy Game will be out in January. This has been Rocket Talk.